Hello and welcome to a special Saturday edition of Coffee House Shots. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Cindy Yu and Sophia Gaston, the director of the British Foreign Policy Group. The coronavirus started in China, yet attention is now in the West where it is surging, and many countries and governments seem ill-prepared. Meanwhile, in the East, countries seem to have the virus under control to a degree. When you look at the curve, it's the countries in the West which are going up at the highest level. Sophia, you've written on Coffee House about how, in a way, lots of the countries in the West that we'd normally expect to be working together have really focused on their own country and there's been little cooperation. Do you think this is part of the reason we're seeing the rates in Europe and America really overtaking the rates in the East?
Well, I think it's important to remember the landscape in which the coronavirus actually arrived. It was really a time of great strain and tension and sort of dynamism, really, in the liberal world order. You had two phenomena that were already taking place simultaneously. So you had the rise of China and the fragmentation of the West. Populism, nationalism, isolationism, protectionism, these four horses of the illiberal apocalypse, they'd been really running ragged and, of course, testing established political parties, multilateral institutions, and I suppose the social fabric of Western nations to their limits. So I think the thing about coronavirus is that it's once a domestic drama. It's all about the nation, the capacities and the power and competence of the state. It naturally compels the tensions inwards. But it's also, as you say, incredibly global in nature. We know the virus spread internationally from its origins in China as a result of our global travel system, our interconnectivity through our global diasporas. And indeed, I think, you know, really, the first people who caught the virus were most likely to be globalists, people attending international conferences, traveling to Italy for ski holidays and so on. Interconnected global markets also mean that we have really asymmetrical supplies of some of the equipment that's really crucial in this battle, whether testing kits or PPE or respirators. And of course, food supply chains are also affected. And I think if you look at the end point to all of this, the vaccine, what we're all working towards, we know this is something that will likely emerge from collaboration across the international community. So it's impossible to separate the international story from this. And I think if we're really hard-nosed about where this is likely to go, and the fact there will be some kind of transition towards a recovery at some point, that race to the sort of economic and social and political dimensions of recovery is going to be incredibly competitive. So I think obviously we can look back at what didn't happen at the beginning. We can look at what's happening, what's not happening now. But I think, you know, we also as the West need to look ahead quite seriously to the future and think about, you know, what's going to happen if China is now allegedly over this first phase and has come out of the blocks all guns blazing, sort of seeking to rewrite history while the West is very distracted.
Cindy, let's talk about China. Ultimately, China is seen as where this virus began. It's received a lot of negative publicity, part for seemingly covering up initially that the virus was an issue. There's some question over the number of fatalities that have been reported. Yet, in recent weeks, we've almost seen China trying to reimagine or rebrand and actually making it into a good PR opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, now that the domestic situation seems to be under control, China is turning its attention to how it will be seen after this crisis is over. More positively, China is sending out its medical experts, sending out its face masks and other supplies to all over the world. Italy, for example, has had video conferences with Chinese experts who gave them advice on how to handle this crisis, having come through it themselves. Earlier last week, Eastern European countries such as Serbia and the Czech Republic received medical supplies from China. And actually, on the runway of the shipment arriving, the Serbian president actually said, "My friend and my brother, President Xi, thank you very much." And then he also said, "European solidarity is only a thing on paper. It's not any more than that." I mean, that's an incredible thing for a Serbian president to be saying. He's not part of the EU, of course, but he is a European country. And the reason he's saying that is at the time he had been asking the EU for more supplies, but given that it's a prerogative that lies with individual member states, they didn't really want to be giving any precious supplies out to anyone else. Now, that might be one case for a non-EU country, but for Italy as well. When Italy was trying to find more medical supplies, it wasn't any European countries that came to its help, it was China. And China is making a song and dance about what it's doing there. A large part of this will be positive PR for what has been a disaster, really, for its soft power image. But also part of it will be that China is worried about a second wave as well, so it doesn't really want an international flare-up either. More worryingly, though, is the negative campaigning that's going on as well. What was a conspiracy theory only a few weeks ago, and I wrote about it at the time, that this virus came from America and was deliberately let loose in China, has now become almost state-endorsed. You've got a spokesman from the foreign ministry tweeting that America has questions to answer, very heavily hinting that this virus originates in America. Now, other figures in the Chinese government, such as the Chinese ambassador to Washington, have disputed that conspiracy theory, calling it crazy. So interestingly, there's a divide within Chinese government about how to approach this. What's interesting as well is that President Trump, stateside, has been seeing this as a PR exercise. That's why, racist or not, he's been calling it the China virus. He wants China to be associated with it because it's a negative thing. He doesn't want China to be associated with the medical efforts. And so you see Trump playing this game as well. But I think the Europeans, if they are to keep up in this game, need to be thinking about it in a much more clever and long-term way.
Now, when we look at how Europe and also America are tackling the virus, there are some clear problems that I think most countries are having. So a lack of PPE, protective equipment, and also a shortage of ventilators. Sophia, do you think there's been an issue here in the sense that, in a way, the West has had a bit of a head start on China in the sense they knew this was a problem in China? You look at, as you mentioned, how the world is connected, it did seem as though this was going to come here, yet lessons weren't necessarily learned.
Yes, I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, there's nothing to say that coronavirus should inherently have encouraged or discouraged cooperation in the West. But I think if we had been more intuitive and really had a grip on how delicate the situation had actually become beforehand, I think we might have taken the opportunity. There's so many ways in which collaboration could have been improved from the get-go. I mean, for example, we could have seen the West consider how to better ensure a more even distribution of crucial supplies. There could have even been more consensus on the approach to addressing the issues around freedom of movement. We saw very dysfunctional approaches to the closing of borders, for example. It was always clear that some countries could be more exposed, and I think that that sense of collective welfare has been really absent. The EU, of course, is on the front line of all of these tensions. It's now trying to claw back a message of solidarity after some initial faltering. I think what's really interesting is that the big old EU member states are the ones who are most affected by COVID-19, at least at this stage. And actually, even they, you know, these champions of solidarity normally, they have been the ones who've been unable to really find that capacity and willingness in the early weeks of the crisis. There's obviously now been some softening from both France and Germany. We're starting to see a more coordinated response. And I think some pretty solid examples of collaboration, sharing of equipment. We're seeing Germany take on some vulnerable patients from Italy and France as well. But I do think it is a problem that the first instinct of these member states was not towards solidarity, because this speaks to big challenges in the EU, that in these crisis moments, we're yet to see a really convincing, instinctive example of solidarity when the chips are down.
And Sophia, just on that, historically, we might expect America to play a leading role here, whether it's, you know, soft or hard power. Why do you think that's failed to happen? Is it Donald Trump as a leader, or is it something else?
I think there's so many things at play here. We know that there had been a long-standing trend towards a more restrained America on the world stage, which even began under President Obama, of course, accelerating into a more kind of protectionist and isolationist frame under President Trump. But I think really importantly, you know, this is a healthcare crisis, and healthcare is America's Achilles heel. And I think because of that, they haven't had the usual opportunities to project both hard and soft power. I mean, if this was a kind of humanitarian crisis or some kind of global conflict, you can imagine the United States would have been there on the front line, you know, first on the scene. But, you know, this plays into this deep weakness that they have. You've also got deep, deep partisan polarization taking place. You've got rampant misinformation. You have a leader who is, you know, fundamentally incapable of harnessing institutions. So I think, you know, as well, you know, a leader like Trump, who makes no secret of his desire for America First approach. So I think with all of that, that sort of alchemy there, it's really difficult to imagine that we will see the United States wanting to play a fundamental role in any kind of coordinated Western response.
And Cindy, just on China, obviously it's had a lot of negative publicity, but now I think as we all watch that graph, which is going around, it shows, you know, the various trajectories of lots of countries, and people are pointing to China as one of a few examples of countries, along with Singapore, South Korea, as places that appear to have got a handle on the virus in a way that places such as Italy and Spain have not. But ultimately, do you think, is that comparison fair? Because clearly China is an authoritarian state and it can get its people to do things in a way that a liberal democracy can't.
That's a really interesting question. I think rarely in the real world do you get such stark comparisons between the benefits and the costs of authoritarian regimes compared to democracies. And coronavirus is one such thing. It's happening in such short succession amongst different political systems. And it's everyone seems to be having the same sort of experiences. And then it just depends on how you sort of deal with it. This is totally a clash of civilizations moment. I mean, if the West and its liberalism means that it deals with the coronavirus worse than China has, you can be sure that China is going to be emphasizing that in its PR campaign in the weeks and the years to come. You can already see Chinese people worried about the Western approach to it. You've got, I reported on Coffee House, of the hundreds of thousands of Chinese people who are leaving Europe to go back to China because they see that as a place where the coronavirus is under control. I think another interesting thing that's come out of this crisis is that it shows that British people, people who live in a liberal democracy, have much more authoritarian instincts than we might think that they do. A YouGov poll this week, for example, finds that 93% of people support a lockdown because of coronavirus. And this is something that people in Downing Street, that Boris Johnson was reluctant to do himself. So, you know, I think in times of great stress and emergency, people do support a more centralised way of doing things. And we've also had reports of the police forces, for example, in the Peak District, using drones to track down people who were flouting restrictions. That was something that the Chinese government started doing whilst it was at its peak, and something that we rightly criticised them for as being almost dystopian. And yet you've got police forces in the UK who have seemingly unthinkingly been doing it, and it's been happening in California as well. So I think this is really a moment where the West really needs to pull itself up by its bootstraps and demonstrate that its system is superior, because if not, the stakes are very high. And also we need to consider that authoritarian instincts might be more natural to more of us than we normally would like to think.
Though I suppose when it comes to authoritarian instincts, what we'll have to keep an eye on is whether perhaps people are willing to comply or be ahead of the government in terms of social distancing measures for a couple of weeks, but they might take a different view if it is months on end. Do you think that could be a difference, Sophia?
I think that there is a sense that governments do need to play a slightly longer term game here. At the end of all of this, or as we transition out of the first phase, I think we are going to face some difficulties in starting to make the case for openness and connectivity again. I mean, if you think about the EU, we've seen all of their internal borders closing and their external borders close as well. I think a policy such as freedom of movement starts to become more complex, and we know that that has been an indivisible freedom. So I think there are all sorts of questions about how this is going to change us as a society. You've seen governments going to extraordinary lengths to intervene, not just on an economic level, but also on the social level. And I think there will be a question about the role that liberalism plays in that kind of recovery. We may see citizens sort of, you know, running to their doors and very keen to move back to a much freer society, perhaps where they felt a little bit more in control of their own destiny. But equally, we could see them becoming quite comfortable with the idea of the state playing a much bigger role. So I think governments where there is a strong sort of philosophical and kind of emotional connection to the identity of the nation as being instinctively liberal, and I would count Britain amongst that, I think they are certainly trying to think about how not to sort of fundamentally alter that national condition. And I think we can see that, for example, in the way in which Boris Johnson and his government have tried to keep some degree of freedoms, certainly compared to some of the somewhat more authoritarian responses that we've seen even in places like Europe.
Thank you, Sophia. Thank you, Cindy.